Hogan would have to be significantly below replacement level to be worse than Bixby.
Hello, and welcome to Expected Own Goals, regular season edition. I'm your host, Eric Morgan, a former soccer writer for Haller and Deadspin.
I'm Evan Davis, analytics columnist for Equalizer Soccer.
And I'm Ariana Cascone, a writer for the Equalizer Soccer and American Soccer Analysis.
Yes, you are.
And now, a regular member of Expected Own Goals.
Oh, yeah.
Ariana, maybe we open up today with an own goal that you and I share.
Uh-oh.
I did. I spent the last couple of days just going through every single preview episode, knowing that there would just be chock-a-block. We're all guilty.
We'll definitely get to other ones later in the show, but because it's relevant for the match we're about to discuss, I believe, Ariana, you and I were both pretty positive about the idea that any keeper would be better than Bella Bixby.
It's true. I want to read a direct quote I wrote. So it's likely that Hogan will be an improvement relative to Bixby's 2023 performances, but that's not saying much. And I think I just set the thorns up for failure in that one.
I think the thorns set the thorns up for failure in this one, if we're being perfectly honest. Let's get into our game of the week. Yeah. The Portland Thorns visiting the Kansas City Current in their brand new stadium, which is some combination of letters that I will never remember. That was one of the wildest games I've ever watched. 5-4 opening day.
It almost broke the record for most goals in an NWSL game.
So we predicted preseason, and again, these were just for entertainment, but I think all of us were really high on Portland and pretty low on Kansas City. But I also think none of us could really foresee the back line that Mike Norris would throw out, and that was a huge factor in those first 35 or so minutes where Kansas City just obliterated Portland.
Now, I do want to make a couple of caveats off the bat, and I think this should extend to all seven games, including the Challenge Cup final, across the weekend. A lot of players did not get a full preseason because of international duty, whether it was with the Gold Cup or with Olympics qualifiers. So a lot of these players are just starting to learn how to play together. And I think we saw, not just with Portland and Kansas City, a lot of, shall we say, incoherence from some sides. And it's always tough, you know, game one jitters. You got to work that out. A lot of coaches are coming in trying to implement pretty severe, like, tactical systemic overhauls with the teams, and that takes time to bed into. So we should say that that is something everyone should bear in mind when they want to roast a team for being terrible or praise a team for being great based on game one results. And primacy bias is a hell of a drug. We have to be careful of it. We don't want to have our final conclusions about any of these teams set by the way that they performed over the weekend.
Oh boy.
However,
I was waiting for the butt.
What a flex by Mike Norris to not roll out one, not roll out two, not roll out three, but roll out four members of the five-player backline goalkeeping squad who have never once probably played together or in the NWSL together before. Simply a masterstroke of buffoonery.
Yeah, and these players are young. Right.
Yeah.
Kelly Hubley is the oldest in Portland's starting backline list over the weekend, and she's 29 years old, and everyone else is 21 or 23.
Jeez. And it sort of felt like watching a pickup soccer team that had never really played with each other just sort of try to get their flow. I felt like we should give Kansas City some credit because they came out, and I think the minute they saw who Portland was playing, correctly identified what they could do to create maximum problem. They saw how tight Portland's midfield was and then allowed the fullbacks, both of whom, Marie Mueller and Nicole Payne, who are very, very green, to sort of have more time, but isolate whatever passes they would have for them. And then once that had sort of taken hold, really found themselves aggressively pressing and applying pressure from there.
I think Mueller grew into the game. I don't think by minute 90 we can hang everything on her, although that left channel, Kansas City's right channel, did get exposed a few times. But and Marie Mueller also has a little bit more seasoning. It's the Nicole Payne of it all that really kind of blew my mind, and maybe to a lesser extent, Isabelle Obese, who I realized I may or may not have been mispronouncing her name, but that's that's for own goals later on. These players really, really don't have a lot of professional experience, period. You know, Obese has her reps in Denmark, but that's Denmark. You know, Nicole Payne had what we determined, like, what, 100 normal time minutes with PSG?
Yeah, something like
107.
Mm-hmm. And those were wins. They were games in which PSG was winning by a lot of goals. So I think it was very clear that Nicole Payne, in a way, I think she looked out of her element. I think it was maybe she was overwhelmed. And sort of like what you're alluding to, Evan, I feel more concerned about Payne than I do Mueller because Mueller's numbers actually look okay from her time in the German professional league. Like if you look at, like, her underlying stats, she's a good passer. She gets involved in the attack. She was key to her team's progression. Like, I think once she settles in with the Thorns and kind of they figure out how they want to play, I can see her growing, not just in one game, but through the season. And I just don't know after that performance if Nicole Payne will settle in as quickly.
It seemed like from the outside that Norris, this is kind of what Norris's preferred back line is going to be going forward. I think in his ideal world, this is what he wants it to be. And you sort of understand it, right? Because Klingenberg and Sauerbrunn just need to be on more restricted minutes just based on age, you know, setting performance aside. But when it's game one, when these players have not had a whole lot of preseason, although this back line has been in preseason, I think, for most of it, most of the winter, which is interesting. An environment that is going to be, shall we say, potent just from a, like, you know, a narrative standpoint, that it's the first quote unquote purpose built women's soccer stadium to ever open, and Patrick Mahomes is there, and ABC is broadcasting the game, and there's just a lot of Sturm und Drang surrounding it. Like, you would think that, like, maybe one player with some experience would be a good idea. Like, yes, you're right, maybe the athleticism from Sauerbrunn would have been less present than, say, like Obese, but like Sauerbrunn could at least be the person to be like, hey guys, chill out, calm down, like, let's get organized here. Or if not Sauerbrunn, Klingenberg, who is also an old veteran, could play that role and also be, you know, offer maybe a little bit more progression on a wing. The rationale for doing everybody at the same time right out of the gate just feels very, very foolish.
And with Shelby Hogan being brand new, like, I just don't. Yeah. If I'm Mike Norris, I'm putting Becky Sauerbrunn on the field if I don't want my backline to get cut up for 90 minutes.
Right.
I felt it was maybe even a little arrogant. In our sort of internal Slack, we were all discussing the fact that Mike Norris was watching the game from the start, not on the sideline, not on the field. It sort of felt like that kind of supreme confidence where one can really just remove themselves from the field with that fresh a team and then put them in so consistently positions that are in front of a sold out crowd on a stadium opening day. Whatever the opposite of helicopter parenting was, free range parenting, that is what that felt like with players. Just really, really criminal. Yeah. And I think at this point, we actually should probably start talking about the goals as they happened, because I think each of the goals sort of reveals a different side of Portland's defensive frailties. The first one is an ill-conceived back pass from Obese to Hogan, and then no passing lane available for Hogan. And yet Hogan decides not to play the ball out, not to hoof it downfield, but to pass it back directly
into Dabinia, of all players.
Into Dabinia's path. Into Dabinia's path. Worse than that, Nicole Payne is absolutely in no man's land on the back post for DiBernardo's finish. It felt like when you discuss, but like plane crashes, that it actually requires several sequential accidents to occur before you have a plane crash. This was like accident, 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 accident in a row. All of it on the shoulders of people who I think maybe shouldn't have been out there to begin with.
FBref breaks down XG by shot, like actually shows you the per chance XG values on their match reports. And DiBernardo somehow managed a 0.87 XG chance and a 0.96 post shot XG. So not only was she like shooting from like dead red, she also fired a bullet into the net. I don't think I need to tell anybody here. Vanessa DiBernardo, not an attacking player.
But that speaks to how high the Kansas City press was, that she was in position to immediately pounce on that.
And was the most advanced midfielder for most of the day.
Yep.
Which is kind of crazy.
The second goal is a Labonte cross into Marie Muller, who has already pressed back a little too deep, but successfully man-marking, and then heads the ball right into the path of Wheeler, who slams it home. That's a ball that Shelby Hogan probably should have come and tried to claim. That's a ball that Muller, who is in a really tough position, should have headed almost anywhere else. And again, is the byproduct of this really effective press, because I believe at that time, Kansas City had like four or five players in and around the attacking area, just sort of speculating on whether that ball would come free. It does. And Portland, and it's a 1-2 punch because 22nd, 25th minute, and Portland, you said it last time, Evan, they get punched in the mouth. Whatever plan they had didn't matter. They'd been punched in the mouth. And then the third is at least a goal that I think beats a lot of defenses. A perfectly weighted ball, through ball, into a gap, past Kelly Hubley, who is powerless to do anything about the ball despite it being in her path, because she can't physically shift her hips in a way no human can, to sort of take anything off that ball, and goes right into Bia's path, and Bia has Obaze beat cold.
Yeah, and on that goal, honestly, Kansas City's buildup was really nice, but yeah. Portland's midfield made them look better, because I took a screenshot of when DiMarotto received the ball, and she's literally on an island. Portland's entire, all three of their midfielders are like snuggling in the corner, like away. And then DiBernardo has all this space in the middle to just receive the ball across her hips and like drive forward and then play that perfect ball through Portland's backline. And Portland's backline is truly so slow. And I don't, obviously, Becky Sauerbrunn being there instead of maybe Obeys or Hubley's going to be playing all season, so that's not even a question. But putting Becky Sauerbrunn in there is not going to make the backline any faster. So I think that's another thing Portland has to think about. Like, they got smoked time and time again in foot races. And there's just no solution for that right now.
Talking about the midfield brings us back to the lack of any sense of cohesion that can develop in preseason, right? Because Coffey and Moultrie were both, and Fleming, they were all at the Gold Cup. So they actually haven't had a chance to play together yet. And there are all of these knock-on effects from the other elephant in the room that we haven't discussed with regard to personnel is why the hell Christine Sinclair was starting this game.
Oh my goodness. I'm so glad you brought this up.
Oh my God.
Because it actually, even though she was being stuck out on the right wing, which is its own problem, she is not a right winger. And so she was continually drifting inside and clogging up central channels, which is where like Moultrie and Fleming were supposed to be living. And then there was absolutely no cohesion to figure out like where everyone was supposed to be occupying space. And then you get those moments like DiBernardo just cutting them open and feeding Bia at the other end. The only justification you can offer for that is that Janine Becky isn't 90 minutes match fit and Hina Sugita is carrying a minor knock that doesn't allow her to start the game either. I can buy Becky just because she's coming back from an ACL injury, but we don't know anything about Hina's health or lack thereof. If Hina was healthy to start the game, why is Sinclair starting that game?
Are you giving Mike Norris the benefit of the doubt that he thought about it that deeply? And you're like, oh, the other players must be injured, so that's why Christine Sinclair started.
I've probably been giving him too much of a benefit of doubt to this point. That's right. But yeah, I mean, this is the one for which I really do not have any rational explanation.
I'm in the same boat.
Other than them hiding a Hina knock, but not bothering to keep her off the roster, the game day roster.
I'm even more confused because you've had Moultrie and Sinclair for your entire tenure as head coach of Portland. Right.
You kind of know what they do.
You do know what these people are, and you know what their skill sets are, and you also understand their limitations, theoretically. And Moultrie, who is not the fleetest of foot, with Christine Sinclair, who is one of the greatest Roman statues to ever play the game, but is a Roman statue at this point in terms of mobility. There's kind of nothing that you can do as far as counter-pressing with either of them. There's nothing you can do in terms of movement. So essentially, Kansas City's handed freedom to go and press because they know that they have time to recover should their press break down.
And I want to mention Claire Hutton here because one of the themes of the weekend, and we'll talk about it at the end when we round up the rest of the games, is that a lot of the lineup surprises for me were playing the kids. You know, we saw Kennedy Fuller getting a start with Angel City. We saw Allie Sentner getting a start at Utah, which was expected, but she kind of tore the doors off the place. And then 17-year-old Claire Hutton getting a start with the Current, playing the number six role, which then frees DiBernardo to get forward and engage in a lot more progression. But Hutton, I think, in part, Portland was making it easy for her, but Hutton had a real shutdown kind of performance in the number six role. Like, she really did not let Fleming or Moultrie build anything through the thirds or allow them to break lines. It was actually a little impressive from someone that young playing a position that really requires a lot of experience and intelligence and awareness, and spatial awareness. Like, to borrow a phrase, it's an old man's role to play the number six. Like, you got to have a strong head on your shoulders, and she hasn't even graduated high school yet. And I thought she was like a real linchpin to allowing Kansas City to know that if their press did get beat or if they did want to sit in a lower block, that she was going to clean stuff up.
Do you think that was true in the second half too?
Not really.
I think once Becky comes in, I think Portland was just a little bit more dangerous and I think able to kind of command the midfield more than in the first half. I mean, that's not saying much because they were not doing it at all in the first half, but...
It's a game of two halves.
Okay, I don't want to be too hot on them after the second half was way better. So the first half set the expectation too low, so I don't want to get stuck in the trap.
The dear sweet Ben Bellman of the ASA show, he is also a hardcore database freak, and he pulled because on American Soccer Analysis's public app, you can play with Team G+ functions by game state. So you can look at like how teams perform when they're two goals up or two goals down or if it's an even scoreline. But it doesn't get any more refined than that. So I asked Ben if he would show me how much G+ Portland was allowing basically in those first 34 minutes, like through Bia's goal when the score became 3-0, and how they performed after that. So the goals added they allowed in those first 34 minutes comes to 0.59, and that's only factoring in passing, dribbling, and shooting. It's not factoring in the receiving values yet, which means that number is going to go up when that gets accounted for. From minute 35 to minute 90, and this is now where we can shift into how Portland kind of reacted to all of this, they only allowed 0.07 G+. Like, after that third goal, they did shut up shop to a certain degree.
Is it that Portland shut up shop or that Kansas City
backed off?
Now three goals up, folded back into a more conservative way of playing. Because I think both are true.
And that was when Dabinia came off too.
Dabinia comes off and that actually does really kill the press. And if Dabinia's hamstring injury...
I mean, Kansas City's already beset by injuries in the attack. I mean, Michelle Prince wasn't available.
Yeah.
Michelle Cooper's not available. If Dabinia goes down, then... What, it's all on Bia and Kristen Hamilton? There but for the grace of God.
But it was a full-scale siege for the first 34 minutes of the game. And then it felt like a very battered Portland team was given more space to operate in. And now we can sort of shift into what Portland is really good at.
Yeah,
because... I don't think this is a good performance, but I think that this is a pretty shocking recovery.
I don't want to give Kansas City too much credit here, quite frankly.
Agreed.
They took their foot off the gas and like retreated, and but they didn't do it well.
No.
You know, like there is retreating into a mid or a low block in order to soak up pressure. And then there's what Kansas City did in the second half.
If you go up 3-0 and are at risk of dropping points at the death, you have fucked up.
Yeah.
It's a 2022 North Carolina Courage. Bleeding goals.
Fair. There you go. And like, okay, so there are a lot of these are low XG chances. Like Sophia Smith's worldie from outside the box in the 43rd minute, 0.03. Becky's in the 71st, 0.09. Smith in the 74th, 0.05, albeit with a really high post shot, which suggests that's just finishing. And same thing with Becky's in stoppage time. So there is a little bit of good fortune that the Thorns were able to play into. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I mean, Becky played for a half and she still put up, what, 0.59 XG plus expected assists? Yep. Like, she was a real terror.
And frankly, if you look over the course of Sophia Smith's career, she's a unicorn. She's just a very good long-range shooter. And you just can't give her that kind of space. She has, I think it's now 10 of her 34 professional goals from outside the box.
She's just unheard of.
And woe be it for you to just back off Soph Smith. Like, you are begging for big problems. Again, when you're a really special player like that, you can create offense almost out of nothing. And that really is what the first Portland goal is. And that is the only foothold they have in the game. And yet after that goal, I think Kansas City reasonably assesses, well, that was sort of a freak thing that just occurred, even if it is a freak who scored it, but then doesn't really reconsider their approach. The goals that they get in the second half, once Portland is really opening this up into a track meet, and it is a track meet, are a huge, colossal error from Hogan. I can't tell whether Chiwenga's, like, really, really good or should just be an Olympic sprinter, but it's a fair question that I think we're going to want to monitor moving forward. But she essentially creates that goal exclusively with pace. And granted, as you've said, Ariana, the back line is so slow. But that only emphasized her pace. I think she beats most back lines to that chance. And Hogan just spills the ball.
Yeah, I watched that back. I don't know. Shelby Hogan's decision-making is something that needs to be worked on. It's truly dreadful. She decides to come out and be really big and then not hold on to the ball. It's like, was she trying to hold on to the ball or she just wanted to parry it away? I don't know. But it ends up just right at the feet of a Kansas City player.
And creates yet another empty net situation.
Mm-hmm. Hogan has been in the league for, this is her fourth season. She has, that was the third game she's ever played.
Jesus.
Was against Kansas City on Saturday.
Is that including the semifinal last year?
No, that's just regular season.
Regular season. Yeah.
So technically it would be the fourth rough with that.
Even so, that's still not enough to know whether she's actually good or not because of how noisy goalkeeper sets are. But totally. What we're seeing is not great.
Your point is well taken that, like, you can scout this player and clearly her decision making is really, really suspect. And just again, mm-hmm. goalkeeper stats are noisy with three seasons of data underneath them. So looking at a single game can't really tell you anything. But it should be noted because Adriana French is another player who I think a lot of attention is going to be put on her just because of how weirdly bad she was last season. This was a very bad goalkeeping performance on both sides of the field. And it's not just the shot stopping. Granted, that's pretty bad too. But like Hogan put up a negative 0.08 claiming score.
Oh, wow.
By American Soccer Analysis' goalkeeping model. That is very hard to do. That is incredibly hard to do. Because the outside of shot stopping, there is not a lot of spread in talent among the other goalkeeping skills, except for passing, but like in terms of just like goalkeeping only skills. Claiming balls, punching balls, you know, doing sweeper actions. It's a very narrow range of skill differentiation you see there. So for her to put up a negative 0.08 claiming score and a negative 0.05 handling score is wild.
It's even more wild because I don't think there's anyone else on the bench that could be tested to if Mike Norris wants to say, like, oh, you let in five goals, now you don't get to play anymore like you did to Bixby last year at the end of the regular season. Like, Lauren Kozel is a second-year pro. She's not played a single minute, I don't think.
Yeah, so he has absolutely no more information, at least statistically.
Right, exactly.
Whether she'd be good or not, yeah. Mike Norris, like, I think I could really see him acting like, you know, the bad boyfriend who's, like, begging to take back the girl he dumped. It's like, Bella, anything we can do. Anything, please. Yeah. I'm sorry for all the things I said.
Lloyd Dobler, speaker overhead, say anything. Please take me back. Mike Norris right now. How do you think Portland got to the place where this is their starting day back line? Like, what decision-making, if we can speculate a little bit, hopping into, because it is both a LeBlanc and Norris decision, how is this acceptable as your back line going out?
Well, I think that it does come from wanting to lay the track for what the backline is going to be long term. And we know that it does take a long time for defenses to start cohering and gelling, because so much of it is about structure and communication and spacing and positioning. And if you're going to make these such a large volume of changes in that area, you can understand why he might want to take it on the chin early so that they all do what they need to do later in the season. Mm-hmm. But I think there was an easier way to roll that out, just given the circumstances. But that's the only way that I can sort of squint and say that is why you'd think it would make sense to do it.
I mean, this is such a...
I know this is hard for you as a Portland-born and bred fella. I know this is really hard, because you're not used to Thorne's defenses looking this bad.
Well, last year they were bad. You don't think
they were not?
I mean, they were bad. They were bad by goals conceded. They were okay by XG, right? Like,
let's see.
They gave up like 26.2 XG or something like that last season, but gave up 32 goals,
right?
Which is really an indictment of Bixby. No, I mean, it's an indictment of lots of other things, but also flat track.
No, you're right.
Yeah, yeah. No, what I mean is like they were bad, but they were bad in a couple special ways that I don't think have a lot to do with why they were bad today. My heart goes out to Nicole Payne, because if I were in her shoes, I would have been shattered after that game. She was struggling to like dribble, to possess, to play. Like it was just like it was the kind of game where like you call the sports psychologist at halftime and just like have them ready, because she's going to need someone to talk. I'm not even joking. Like she's going to need someone to talk to.
Does Reyna Reyes come into the side next week?
I don't know why she wasn't in before the 75th minute.
Yeah, that's probably a change I would have made at halftime.
But it also like lends these weird suspicions I have that Norris doesn't trust her. You know, because they're like, why was Payne signed in the first place when you had Reyes there? You know, like they had a fair amount of fullback depth already, and then they brought Payne in, and then all of a sudden Payne is starting on day one. You know, granted, like Reyes had the Gold Cup, but Mexico got knocked out in the semifinals, so there was 5 extra days of rest and availability in training before the season started that you would maybe think she'd be ready.
My hypothesis, based on no one has told me this, I have really no inkling of why I think this, but Payne coming from PSG, I think Portland's people in charge are like, oh yeah, PSG is good. Like, this player's really good. She should be starting in our back line, even though we have Reyes, who played in the NWSL last year. Like,
is that, when you say people in charge, do you think that's the new ownership, or do you think that's
LeBlanc? I was thinking LeBlanc kind of Norris duo situation, not ownership.
Yeah, I don't think ownership has boots on the ground about this kind of stuff yet. But if that's the case, then it's so maddening, because like LeBlanc is not, she's not new to the job.
No.
You know, yeah. This is her third season as the Thorns general manager.
I think we should talk about sort of elements of this game that are freakish, because the XG on this game is like not absurd.
Yeah, 1.7 to 1.2 in Kansas City's favor.
It's the goals and the kind of goals conceded that are both an absurd indictment on Portland's back line, but also like to compliment Kansas City, a really solid game plan from them from the jump. And persistent attacking. I think Kansas City plays essentially a flawless first 35. They had 11 shots before the 34th minute. That's crazy.
That is.
I hadn't seen that stat yet.
And they were just constantly taking the ball off Portland and turning it into like heavy metal goal scoring chances. Dibinha in the 22nd minute nearly scores, what, with a 0.14 XG shot? Like, this game is, Kansas City's after it right from the jump.
They allowed negative 0.08 G+. They allowed negative 0.08 G+ in those first 35 minutes, which means their defense was actually turning the game into attack.
I mean, that says it all,
yeah,
frankly, as far as I'm concerned. So how does Portland get back in this one? What are the changes, and what can Portland look at and say, okay, this isn't all doom and gloom?
I think Janine Becky coming in for Sinclair opened things up a ton.
I think it's just Becky, frankly, and like maybe just calming of some nerves in the back line. But like Becky turns into the only real attacking force besides Morgan Weaver that they had, you know, for all of, you know, it's interesting. I was looking at Jesse Fleming's data and comparing like what FBREF has against the G plus values that ASA generates. Cause she had 11 progressive passes and carries on the day, which on its face seems like, oh, you're getting that from your number eight. Great. Love that. But that translates to 0.01 passing value above average and negative 0.01 dribbling value above average. So what that suggests is that like the work that she's doing in progressing the ball is falling down on the next possession action. That like what she's generating, how whatever its quality, is not actually coming to anything on the next possession move once she releases the ball.
Yeah. I do think she was more effective, though, by my eye test. At least more involved, even if maybe the underlying numbers are not.
In the second half, you mean? Or
in the second half. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I agree.
Yeah, I think Becky opens up so many things. It's that Becky is able to incisively cut inside or go out to the wing, mixes them up unpredictably, and is essentially a catalyst for the offense.
It's really wonderful to see, by the way, because that's who Janine Becky has always been. Mm-hmm. And to know that like she's going to have that in her locker now after the ACL layoff should really excite Thorns fans, because it's also a different kind of right wing profile than what you get with Hina. You know, like she is much more dribbly. Mm-hmm. She's got a lot more pace on her than Hina does. Maybe a little bit less defensive steel, but she is so versatile on that right wing. To like have her playing off of Sophia Smith and Olivia Moultrie in that corner, I think is going to be really, really, really successful. And Norris has to pull his head out of his ass about Sinclair ever being a member of the starting 11 again.
Yeah, I mean, Becky, if Becky's not on the field, then goals 2, 3, and 4 for Portland really don't happen, right? Because she scores off a corner.
Right.
She is the one that I think toe pokes the ball to Sophia Smith, mm-hmm. who kind of like dances around Kansas City's 18 and then gets a shot off that somehow goes in. No angle, players smothering her. That's like true unicorn stuff. And then Portland.
I think I've gotten carried away with the unicorn thing, but yes.
And then Portland goal number 4, right, is like a Janine Becky shot from distance. So
like a total bullet.
Like, kind of the goal of the day.
So yeah, no, I think you need all your weapons, man. Like you cannot go through this game with one hand tied behind your back. I think that like Megan Klingenberg probably needs to come back into the side, at least to like settle Payne's nerves. If you don't trust Reyes, you know, Mueller and Klingenberg as a fullback partnership feels like it makes a lot more sense. Just in this early going until everybody starts to feel more comfortable with each other.
So I have a question about Payne. So I found at times she was kind of just out of position or just not in the right place. And so Kansas City's last goal kind of depicted that really well for me. So Labonte drives centrally and then Payne just decides to follow her. And then Labonte plays Hamilton out wide and then Payne never shifts over and the back line doesn't move either. So now Hamilton has all this space to play the ball in and essentially it ends up being a goal. And so if Payne is able to figure out like the positioning and kind of how to get where she needs to be on time, is she a good enough one-on-one defender to play 90 minutes week after week?
I think
Portland?
Just in the abstract, you'd say yes, just because she's young, and if PSG thought she was good enough to at least be on the squad, there must be something there. But I certainly can't say that for sure because we don't have the data, and we really don't have the eye test either. So I don't know. I genuinely don't know.
True.
My gut says she might have been good enough to get to PSG, but she was not good enough for PSG to care very much if they let her go. And I think that there is a bigger question that exists about Portland's scouting and its analysis.
Or lack thereof.
That ends up with her in day one starting position. Mm-hmm. Essentially, anything that could go wrong did. And it was just as much, I don't know what the instruction was, but it did feel like a lot of freelance solo defending without consciousness about the system that she was playing in that created problems that knocked on to every other member of the backline. There's a moment in the first half where the camera just cut to Kelly Hubley, who looked like I don't even know what to do with this. Like, I am battered. Yeah. I have no idea. Like, what do you even say right now? Right. And I felt like Nicole Payne was a big contributing factor to that. But also, is this, and I guess this is what I'm getting at with the question, is this a thing Portland is going to be strapped with for a while, or is this a thing Portland can solve? Like, has this game adjusted your priors about Portland?
No, it hasn't. I just, again, because I think it's very, very dangerous to fall victim to primacy bias here. Like, and you know, we could, maybe this is a good time to like move to just talking about everything else going on around the league. Like, nobody really played well. And North Carolina's dominance of Houston feels more like an indictment of Houston being terrible on the day than mm-hmm. North Carolina necessarily being great. So, it just, every game felt disjointed to one extent or another. Teams just like not playing well for 20, 30 minutes or for 90 minutes. No cohesion being found in any midfield, you know, no fluidity. All these teams feel like works in progress to me. So I don't think that Portland can't fix this. Again, like, bench Payne. There you go. You know, bench Sinclair.
And I think their midfield, they have enough personnel in their midfield to make changes there and kind of be able to mm-hmm. make up for how bad their back line might be. Whereas we were talking about their midfield cut them in the first half was mm-hmm. less effective than they should have been, probably. So I think playing in the next couple of games, we'll probably see Portland's midfield get more cohesive and just better overall. Even if we don't see that from the back line, I think it will make overall the team performance a little bit stronger.
You'd think, because those three players are too talented and too intelligent not to make it work with each other.
I think the only thing that's adjusted for me is the problem of Shelby Hogan that seems not as immediately fixable.
Sure.
They just don't have another goalkeeper.
Transfer window is open for another month, which is the other thing we need to remember, that transfer window is open for another month, and then the summer window happens after the Olympics. So a lot of these lineups won't look the same by the season's end.
Do you think that Kansas City has, any of your prayers about Kansas City have adjusted? Again, I don't think anybody should be making any large assessments after week one, but was this sort of the Kansas City team, when you look at it, that you kind of expected? Or is this a brighter, better team than you'd expected?
I think tactically they were sort of what I didn't see a lot of width from them. You know, mm-hmm. they played pretty narrow, which is what you assume that Vlatko Ananovsky is going to do. I think that the midfield is looking quite balanced, but that's the same midfield that they had last year when everyone was healthy. So that's a good sign. Claire Hutton is a very exciting discovery. If it turns out that just wasn't Portland being bad and a lot of it was also Claire Hutton being good, that's really, really exciting. Because she looked so composed out there. So I think maybe they've got more, and they're going to need her because the back line is also in the middle of an injury crisis. Yeah, I don't know. I think if my priors are adjusted on Kansas City at all, it's just that, like, once again, they've just got so many players on the training table. And can they ever get their best 11 on the field at the same time? I don't know. Like, it's kind of hilarious, like, what they went through at the beginning of 2023, they're kind of going through again.
I agree. The only thing I wanted to say is that I thought Gabby Robinson looked more composed and like an NWSL center back in her first game of the season this year, and that was just like leaps and bounds better than we saw start of season last year from her. So
with Robinson, the bar was set very low.
That is very true, and I was someone who kind of beat that horse, like, Robinson should not be starting, she shouldn't be starting for Kansas City. I said that over and over again last year. So that I'm just pointing out, because maybe that is that might give Portland hope, like, that their young center back had a really bad day too, and doesn't mean it's going to be the end of the world.
Yeah.
Let's talk about everything else that happened this weekend, because we had two debutantes.
I kind of want to think about this maybe thematically. I just saw some interesting kind of through lines, both tactically and analytically.
Oh, yeah. Take us through them.
Again, for one thing, like, the kids really, like, playing the kids really was brought front and center with what Hutton did. And also Alex Pfeiffer, we should mention Alex Pfeiffer, all of 16 years old, became the youngest ever NWSL regular season scorer, which is very impressive.
Really fun goal.
Super fun goal.
And the celebration was awesome. Yeah,
great goal.
And she was robbed of a full-blown knee slide celebration because the current didn't water the pitch enough. So she just stopped dead in her tracks on her knees. But I love that. I mean, so yeah. So Hutton and Pfeiffer playing well for Kansas City. Kennedy Fuller, 17-year-old midfielder with Angel City. You and I were at that game last night, Eric. She posted 0.92 XG plus expected assists on 3 shots and 3 key passes. That was number 2 on the weekend out of 144 outfield players who played at least 45 minutes.
Yeah, she looked...
She looked the real deal.
Really ready for the occasion. Yeah, she looks...
Unlike Nicole Payne.
She Kennedy Fuller looked like somebody who's maybe going to make me eat my hat about Angel City.
Well, how are we supposed to know? Like, were you watching Kennedy Fuller's high school tape? No, of course not.
But you know, Angel City has had the strategy of taking these risks on a lot of teenagers, and it kind of looked like, again, it could be a one-off, but it kind of looked like they hit at least with this one.
Not the one anyone expected. Everyone thought it was going to be Giselle Thompson that was going to be the breakout, and she looked good in her 10 minutes, but it was just a 10-minute cameo. She moves exactly like her sister, which is very funny. Like, if you just didn't look at their faces, you'd be like, oh, yeah, this is the same person, the way that they run.
Were either of y'all, like, shocked to see that she only played 10 minutes? I was kind of like, what?
I don't know. I mean, 18 years old, she needs to get bedded in. That didn't blow my mind. I mean,
I don't know. There's a lot of hype in that Angel City circle.
Yeah, but that's Angel City hype. It comes with an asterisk. Fair. Yeah, and then, like, Allie Centner, who we all knew was going to be a starter, like, what... She was a defensive menace against Chicago, which, like, I didn't necessarily see coming. Like, she was playing.
I didn't either, and I watched a ton of Allie Centner in college.
Right, well, yeah, you're right there at Chapel Hill. Like,
yeah, I was right there. Saw her in person. Really, really fun on the ball. Like, I expected that from her in the attack, but working really hard defensively. I think. I don't know. She's kind of like wanting to prove herself. Maybe.
Hard work and grit. You know, she's got to live up to head coach Amy Rodriguez's objectives. Amy Rodriguez looking great on the touchline. It looks exactly like what you want out of a professional head coach. The majority of Centner's touches were in the defensive third, and it's not because Chicago was pinning Utah back. She was just tracking back like a motherfucker. She got 16 on-ball defensive actions from the left wing / left midfield position.
That's like Lynn Williams-esque.
Yeah, I know.
It's very good.
It's crazy. Yeah, so obviously, like, 0.07 interrupting a value above average, that's first among all 49 attackers who played at least 45 minutes over the weekend.
Yeah, Allie Centner looked like a number one pick, a well-made number one pick.
Truly.
But not in the way you expected, but also she was good going forward as well.
0.04 passing above average. That's in the mix for among the best on the weekend for attackers, without a doubt. Did anybody watch Washington-Seattle with any closeness? Because I wanted to talk about Croy Bethune and if anyone had any thoughts about how she did in her first start. It was not a great day out at the office for Washington in general.
No, I watched that game passively and I saw afterward that most of Seattle's players were like in Washington's half the majority of the time.
Yeah.
Wild.
Jisoo Yun looked like she hadn't skipped a beat from her Chelsea days.
Oh, yeah.
Which is very heartening, but also Washington was not putting up much of a fight, so we have to see if that actually sticks in terms of her performance. But she looked really... I mean, if Jisoo Yun can roll back the years like that, all of a sudden the conversation we have about Seattle's attack is very different.
It was the most Seattle game as well. They allowed 0.0 XG. They scored on a penalty in the third minute. And then they were just like...
No. In the first minute, wasn't it?
The penalty was drawn, I believe, in the first minute. It wasn't taken until the third minute.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah. I mean, credit to them. They harried and chased for a second goal for a little while. They didn't immediately park the bus, but yeah, it was a little tangential. Some very disappointing attendances from some teams. Speaking of Seattle, like Seattle only had about 8,500 at Lumen Field. North Carolina under 6,000 at Wake Med.
That's a record for them.
I think I tweeted when that got posted. I was like, I don't think this means what you think it means. You're just cracking 50% capacity for a home opener in your eighth season.
And it was truly a gorgeous day in the Triangle.
Was it?
Like, you could not have asked for better weather here.
Criminal. Mm-hmm. Absolutely criminal.
I want to question what a sellout means to Utah.
20,000 in that field.
Because I look at that stand, and I'm like, that's 50, 60% full. Now, they may have sold all of those tickets, but you look at the game itself, and I was just like, this, fine, call it a sellout. But I see a lot of empty seats here.
They made up for it. The supporters made noise. And
oh, yeah. No, it was a great atmosphere.
That game was broadcast on ION, and I think that's the one area where we had a lot of questions about, like, what are the broadcasts going to be like on ION? But honestly, I thought they had one of the better broadcasts of the weekend. Like, picture was really sharp, was in 1080p, I believe. And more importantly, the production sound for the game itself really felt like genuine atmospheric sound, which is not always the case in NWSL produced broadcasts. So I got to give them credit.
They really let us know because they were without commentary for about 15 minutes due to technical difficulties.
The one flaw.
I have never seen technical difficulties come up on the little score bug.
Right.
And it came up during that game. But I was like, you know what? I'm pretty into this like postmodern minimalist take on the way a soccer game should be experienced. I feel very there. Mm-hmm. And yeah, Utah's fans were good.
Half of the time I listen to NWSL streams on mute, so I probably wouldn't have been mad about that.
No, I think I was very much enjoying it.
We all know which color commentators we don't want to listen to. We don't need to name them.
Oh, my God.
Yes, true.
But yeah, no, it's just very frustrating. Like, Louisville only had about 6,000 at their home opener. It's just very frustrating for teams in this moment, at this moment in the league's history, with all of the history those teams have behind them, to still only be pulling that kind of crowd when the curtain goes up on the year. But meanwhile, Angel City, 22,000. Gotham, 14,000 for the Challenge Cup. KC sold out 11,500 for the inaugural match at CPKC Stadium. So there is...
Is that what it is?
What's that?
CPKC,
is that what it is? Yeah. You'll get it one day.
KFC Stadium, yeah, got it.
And then the cherry on top, it's so weird. Like, we're just at this moment where so much stuff that's worth talking about is happening, whether it's the Gold Cup overlapping with the start of the season, but then also, like, Chelsea played Arsenal at Stamford Bridge on Friday in front of a record crowd for Chelsea women at Stamford Bridge, 33,000 people, and demolished Arsenal. Like, I would give 30 minutes to talk about just that game, and we got to go.
We'll just do our own goals and call it.
Okay.
Oh, let's rapid fire these. I said that Alyssa Melanson plays for the Utah Royals. She in fact plays for Bay FC, whatever. We doing both teams on the same day. Call it a brain cramp. Kieran said that Howe was frustrated with the idea of the NWSL managing the break for the Olympics, and also like how he'd fit Challenge Cup games in throughout the season. We all know Challenge Cup is done, and the league is just taking a 6-week break in July and August for the Olympics. I said that Rebecca Holloway is a center back option for Racing Louisville. She is not, because she does not play for them anymore. Susie Rance, when talking about the Seattle Reign, mentioned talking to Erica Dombach. She said on the audio, Erica Wambach, obviously. Abby Wambach does not have a sister we're not aware of. I really care about players' pronunciation of players' names, and I've screwed up a few of those, so I got to own that. It's Linda Motalo from South Africa, currently Racing Louisville winger. Isabella Obez, which I think actually has a little bit of a final vowel accent based on some of the Nigerian television broadcasts I've been watching. Brazilian midfielder for the Chicago Red Stars. I've been saying this wrong for a long time. It's Julia Bianchi, not Bianchi. And Rachel Kundinanji does have the final vowel pronounced at the end of her name. I am so pathetically deaf. Let's just wrap it up there. You can follow us on social media at XOwnGoals. That's the letter XOwnGoals, including Blue Sky. Please rate us, review us, follow us either on the ASA feed or on our feed. Please rate us 5 stars if you are going to rate us at all. And if you think we have an own goal, we will cop to it on the air. Please email us at expectedowngoals@gmail.com. That's the letter expectedowngoals@gmail.com. Now I'm sitting here talking to myself. That's chaos.
I assumed you'd crush it. You're a pro.